Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. As a highly sought-after consultant, super connector, trusted advisor, celebrity wrangler, and thought leader, I connect innovators and influencers from Silicon Valley to Hollywood to Madison Avenue. As a trusted advisor, I transform the quality of people's lives. And I'm also the author of the best-selling ebook, The Magic and Moxie of Apple, An Insider's View. Tonight's guest on the show is Clayton, the artist behind the acclaimed one-man musical project that we know as Cellar Dweller. Clayton is a multi-instrumentalist. He's an artist, producer, songwriter, performer, programmer, and remixer. Known for his extensive sound design and production work, Clayton's Cellar Dweller music is a hybrid fusion of digital and organic elements. Intricately designed soundscapes that take cues from electronic genres like drum and bass, electro, and dubstep, woven together with aggressive rock, metal, and orchestral elements. Cellar Dweller music has been featured in countless TV shows, films, and video games, including Need for Speed, Dead Rising, RoboCop, Iron Man, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, X-Men, Call of Duty Elite, and CSI Super Bowl Spot. He is also co-scoring Killer Instinct Season 3, and his latest album, End of an Empire, was just released via 6XT on November 6, 2015. Welcome to the show, Clayton.
I feel welcome. Thank you. And to set the record straight right from the top, it's Cell Dweller. So it's just Cell Dweller, one word.
It's
is the project.
Cellar.
Yep.
Excuse me. I appreciate
that's okay.
That.
It actually was born from Cellar Dweller because my mom would come down in the cellar where she was gracious enough to let me make all kinds of noise and would always tell me to get out of the cellar, and she started calling me a Cellar Dweller, and eventually that is what I adopted as my name, was a Cell Dweller.
I love that story. And, of course, you know, that second L kind of could look like an I, so it's hard to really get that nailed.
Yeah, that's
but
okay.
But in any event, it's great to have you.
I've been called way worse, believe me.
I believe it. Well, I like to start these shows, Clayton, by talking about the role of a trusted advisor and a mentor. And I wonder who some of the mentors have been along the way in your journey and whether you've mentored others.
I mean, for the first part of that question, my mentors have really been the people who have been closest to me. I have had very little interaction with people kind of outside of my circle saying, oh, hey, you're really talented. I'd love to come and teach you the way. In fact, I would spend a lot of my time early on in my career trying to get the attention of those people to basically just give me a break, teach me something, give me some kind of opportunity. Pretty systematically, the door gets shut in your face, and that's why I learned a valuable lesson that the people around you that you trust are the ones that are most important to take advice from. So at that time, it was my manager at the time, who was Tyler Bacon, who was a friend of mine for many years, still is. And later on, James Rhodes, who ended up becoming my first employee ever, and now is general manager of my entire company, Fixed. So,
wow.
You know, there are people like this, as well as other people in my company, Josh Danforth, who heads up social media, and Brett, even, who is Blue Stolly. He's one of the artists signed to my label. These are guys that, like, I will oftentimes go out to lunch with, have conversations with, hop on the phone, exchange emails, and basically say, hey, this is what I'm working on. And I can always get an honest opinion back. And they're not always the opinions you want to hear, because you want to hear everything that goes out the door. You want to hear, oh, that's great, we love it. But I see a lot of people around me that are surrounded by yes men. And so everything they do, everyone's like, oh, it's great, because they don't want to offend this person. And what ends up happening is you end up just making bad career decisions because everyone's telling you it's great, and it's really not. So
I
set a precedent.
No one's saying that the elephant in the room, you know.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing. I set a precedent in my company. Like, I'm a New Yorker, man. It's like I'll say what I mean, and I mean what I say, and that's the way I was raised, and that's what I expect from everyone around me. So if I ever feel like I'm getting yes to death or someone's telling me something just because they think I want to hear it, I'll kind of call them out on it right away and say that's really not the way to feed me information. It's like, I want the truth. I want your opinion. And it doesn't mean I'm always going to listen to you, but I just want I want the truth in your opinion.
Well,
and then as far as mentoring,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of a little weird for me to be like, oh, I mentored this person and that person. It's really, you could ask other people, how I've mentored them. But a classic example would be somebody like Brett, who is Blue Stolly, the artist Blue Stolly, who was signed to my label. And he was, you know, he was lived in Arizona, and he was working at a medical facility at the time, and he wanted to come intern for me and just basically work in my studio. And it took a while for him to actually get in the door because I kind of resisted the idea of anybody being in my studio with me. And when he finally did, I realized pretty quickly this kid is way more talented than just sitting here and chopping up beats for me. And so I started actually teaching him what I knew about production. I'm not really protective about how I produce because I could teach somebody everything I know and they still can't do what I do because I can't even really tell them how to do what I do. I just do it. But yeah. Brett took what I taught him and ran with it and has been wildly successful even in his own right. So there's one example of, you know, I've worked really hard and I've come up against a lot of closed doors. And so any information that I've gained through experience and failure and sometimes success, I'm willing to share with other people who I know that this information is meaningful to them. I'm not just like pearls before the swine kind of guy where I'm just going to throw it out there and people just disregard it. If I think that somebody wants that information and feel like they are really receptive to it, that's when I'll share what I have to teach.
That's the way to pay it forward as far as I'm concerned. And as far as your comment about people that are willing to tell you the truth, this is one of the compliments I get in the role of a trusted advisor all the time is, sometimes you are the only person in that individual's life who's willing to tell them the truth because they are surrounded by yes men, whether they're rock stars or tech innovators. And it seems the more successful you get, the more you're surrounded with people like that. And that's not going to be to your advantage for all the reasons you pointed out.
But, you know, there are people who, I mean, for them it's all about the ego, so they want to hear everyone around them tell them that everything is great. But I think that's kind of that's a road to failure right there. I mean, there's not really a long-term plan in place if you just want people around you who are going to just tell you every idea you have is great, because when you don't have a great idea and everyone's telling you it is great and then you execute it and fail, who do you blame?
Yeah, exactly right. And so one of the ways I get around that is I really question the assumptions and the statements they make. And I say, have you really thought about that? Does that really feel right to you? You know, and we kind of dive in and address all that and pick it apart because very few people will do that with these guys. So anyway, to your point, let's dive in a little bit more, Clayton, on your new album, End of an Empire. I'm curious what listeners can expect from this latest installment and what's been called a pioneering vision of the future of electronic music.
Well, I never really know how to answer those kinds of questions because I never really know how to define what it is that I do. So I don't know what you can expect. I mean, you can expect, if you want to break it down into musical terms, you can expect big, aggressive guitars and a lot of really cool synth sound design and melodic vocals and big drum beats and melody all over the place, and it's an amalgam of Cell Dweller as a whole is an amalgam of just anything I'm into, anything I've been influenced by. I'm not an artist where I go, hey, this is my sound, I fit into this category.
This is your theme of this particular project.
What's that?
You don't do a particular project around a theme necessarily.
Well, thematically, as far as lyrics and a look, yes. But musically, I am who I am. I make what I make, and I go with whatever I'm inspired by. Visually and lyrically, this album definitely has a theme, which we'll get into in a little bit.
Yeah,
but there is definitely a story around it, and it's primarily because my music tends to be more cinematic. I think in very cinematic terms. So since the beginning when I made music, I was basically trying to create a score to a movie that hadn't been made and one that I just see in my head. I'm just picturing these different scenes, you know, worlds exploding and people invading and whatever it might be, and I'm creating sound that I felt could work in those scenarios. So I've always worked in visual terms. So releasing music has been, it's never been good enough for me to just go, here's 10 songs, enjoy. Like, I've always felt like I've had to put visuals and some sort of story to it somewhere along the way.
And it sounds like your fans have come to expect that, obviously.
The pressure is on. Now I feel like if I don't do that, they're gonna pick it outside my studio, and then I'm in real trouble.
Well, and we talked about this actually before we went live, but this whole notion of Wiki not having information be accurate. Now, I'm not sure what I know and what I don't know. You know, I worked with Skinny Puppy when I was in A&R at EMI many, many years ago. And, of course, Depeche Mode. These guys were some of the early electronic music pioneers.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wonder, is that a genre, if you're forced to pick a genre that you fit into? You know, has electronic music become EDM? Is there a difference? Do we care? Does it matter?
I mean, EDM to me is just it's a label that they put on electronic music here in America.
Yeah.
I don't really know, to be honest. I mean, to me, EDM has become what 80s hair metal was in the 80s. It's like you had a couple of bands that had a sound and they were doing something really cool, and then you had 10,000 other bands trying to rip that sound off using the same exact guitar tones, writing the same types of songs, and it just ends up becoming a parody of itself. And it's like, that's why it doesn't really matter what the label is. It's just like, what as an artist, what are you making musically? It doesn't matter if it's EDM or metal or jazz.
I guess to rephrase the question, if I might, Clayton, it's more about the influence of that kind of music back then on what has shaped into what your music has become.
Oh,
well,
my music is becoming
more clarity on some of those early influences.
Yeah, I mean, for early influences for me, it was stuff going back even to Kraftwerk
maybe
even Herbie Hancock and things.
Wow.
You know, 70s yeah. electronic music. My grandfather would put records on, and he had
like
Rocket
even.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that was an amazing track. I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without hearing that. And it was such a new sound for America specifically. Europe has always been really open to electronic sounds, and America has always resisted it because, you know, this is the home of rock and roll, and so that kind of dominated the radio waves.
Right.
But then later on it was bands like Skinny Puppy, bands like Depeche Mode, of course. And of course you look at that and you go, well, Depeche Mode was probably influenced by Kraftwerk, and they'll come
out and say it.
You know, so it's like you see the progression of an artist influencing another artist who influenced another artist, and it's just generational.
And,
so,
you know, I even published a book called The Art of Digital Music some time ago that you probably find pretty interesting with a lot of these kind of guys in it about what was happening in the early days. Chemical Brothers and all these guys that were out there doing stuff. Even Thomas Dolby. It's just great to kind of get a sense for the grounding of what really lit a fire underneath you back when it all started.
Styx was a great example. I mean, I was a kid. I didn't really know much about music, but I remember hearing this song, and this robot was singing in the song, and it was Mr. Roboto. And
Mr. Roboto, yeah.
Yeah, I was fascinated by the sound. Like, how could you get – like, that sounds like a robot, but he's saying the lyrics to the song. How is that even possible? And it would
Dennis
take years.
Dennis DeYoung was – you know, the sounds of Styx in those days were heavily around his synth and a lot of his lyrics and his visuals. I think he's kind of like you are. I think he's very visual in his writing. And
mm-hmm.
Big orchestral-type visions, almost operatic, if you like.
Yeah. Yep,
and then the rock music kind of fit into that. It's one of the things the guys railed about later on. You'll hear Tommy and Jim and JY say, "God, we won't play Mr. Domo Arigato, Mr. Roboto. We won't ever do that again because they can't stand what that was all about. They were a pure rock band."
Right, and it's like it was too Broadway, I think, for them, or maybe too polished, But it struck a chord with me because it was telling some kind of story. I mean, if you listen to the lyrics, it's telling a story. There's a highly technological aspect to that song. It was like there were synthesizers. There was this, what I now know is a vocoder, but back then I didn't know what it was. I thought it was an actual robot singing, which was amazing.
The voice modulation, yeah. Vocoders were way cool back in the 80s, and they were very early, even late 70s.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is there, as far as the end of an empire, could you kind of dive in a little bit and tell us a bit about maybe one of your favorite tracks and the artistic journey you envisioned from inception to completion, so we get a better visual into the mind of how you work?
That would be a dangerous place to go, but I don't know if anybody wants to
especially
go into my mind.
Frankly, yeah, I'm sure.
You know, there's a song called Heart On, which is really a double entendre. It's intentional.
I bet. Yeah.
It really was actually a clothing line that I had in my head for a few years. I had written down some sketches, but never actually turned it into a clothing line. And I actually ended up making it a song instead, and then releasing merch that had that theme on it anyway. But you know, the idea was just kind of beyond just the lyrics. One of the things that stands out in the making of that track was kind of like a four on the floor dance beat, a pounding dance beat with heavy guitars over it, and a lot of the sound design that I did on the track, in fact, across the entire album, was done with analog synthesizers. I have a big modular synth setup, which if you search that online, you'll find it very quickly. You'll see tons of pictures of my studio with lots of knobs and wires. And so a lot of my sound design on this album wasn't done in the box, in the computer, using software. It was used making hardware, used by taking hardware, recording it in, and then processing that further. But
that
putting that song together and hearing it actually come together, all these elements that really many people would tell you technically don't belong in the same track, hearing it come together was cool, because it makes sense in my head, and it makes even more sense when I finally dial in a track and go, see, I knew this could work.
Listen, it goes all the way back to the Beatles with the psychedelic stuff they were doing with Sgt. Pepper and stuff, and putting clips together that seemed wacky and nobody understood it. You just have to follow your own definition of creativity, and it doesn't really matter if people follow you or not. The good news is a lot of people do follow you.
Mm, yep.
So, and I know that you released the CD under your own independent label, Fixxd, Clayton. Tell us a bit about the current vision and fabric of Fixxd. You mentioned earlier some of your friends that have come up and helped you run it, but, you know, what really led you to decide I'm going to run my own label?
Failure was one of them. Bad record deals was another one. I've signed so many bad deals. And really, I'm sure this information is online in all sorts of places because I have talked about these things. But I probably should have just given up making music. Dozens of times. I mean, I've hit so many walls, and including these bad record deals. So what ended up happening is I found that I was able to make things happen on my own, even if I didn't know what I was doing, more than if I trusted somebody who I thought knew what they were doing with my product, with me,
right,
with my artistic output. And so after getting bent over the couch, so to speak, so many times in this industry by so many people, and I'm not playing a martyr here, because if I was playing a martyr, I wouldn't be actually doing anything in my career. I would just be online whining about all the wrongs that have been done to me. I was just tired of it, and I'm a New Yorker, dyed-in-the-wool New Yorker, and it's always been in my character to I can't wait. I'm very impatient. Like, if someone's not going to do it, I'm going to get up and I'm just going to do it myself, even if I don't know what I'm doing. And that's
right,
really how it started. I just started learning how to manufacture my own discs, doing my own artwork, doing my own photo shoots. I was manufacturing my own merchandise or figuring out how to get it manufactured. And then I was actually stuffing the bags and processing the credit card orders myself, completely by myself.
I love it.
And that's really how it started. And after this started building, and James Rhodes, who ended up becoming my first employee, he was a fan, and he just kept knocking on my door and kept saying, hey, give me something to do. I'd love to help you. And I resisted because I didn't want anybody screwing up all the things that I had built, because I didn't trust anybody. When I finally had given it to him and he made it a lot better than it was when I was doing it, I started giving him more responsibility. And I started going, hey, I'm building this little cottage industry here, a little kind of system where if I had another artist or two, I could plug them into the same things I'm doing for myself and
yep,
help them. And it was
mm-hmm.
really based around my brother, Level was his artist name. And he, same thing, he could make music, but he didn't know how to manufacture it, get it distributed, and he really, quite honestly, didn't want to bother with that. So I was like, hey, let's just get my brother going here. And that's really how it started.
And this is very similar, as you may have heard, to the story of my friend Derek Sivers, who started CD Baby.
Yeah, yep.
You know, there he was, a struggling musician, and he had a bunch of friends. He wanted to help him out. His story was almost identical to yours. And do you know what the best part was? He sold the company for $20 million a couple years ago.
Yep, I heard that story.
And the better part is that he only kept enough for himself to live on for the rest of his life, and the bulk of those proceeds went to a foundation to support other musicians.
And yeah, you don't often see that in
no,
the industry, unfortunately.
And by the way, just a little aside, because I don't know how much you know about me. Before I started the music focus at Apple, because I was the original music executive at Apple, I was an A&R exec at EMI, a young one. I couldn't stand what I was watching happen to artists. And Todd Rundgren and I, 20 years ago, started a company to help artists go direct to their fans and help the, have the fans underwrite these projects directly. And this
right.
is called Patronet, as an homage to the patrons of the Medici era, where artists could be underwritten directly by their own fans and liberate themselves from the labels. So,
and there are artists now that do nothing but that. Their whole careers are based on Patreon or YouTube income or Spotify income, where the fans are directly, you know, even Kickstarters, the fans are directly
responsible. And Patreon looks like, oh, this great new thing. We did it with Patronet 20 years ago.
There you go.
So I really applaud you having just, you know, pulled your bootstraps up and said, I'm going to do this, not just for myself, but for other artists. And how did you manage to do that without any investors or outside help? Just
very, very slowly and very painfully. I mean, if you look at the trajectory of Fixxd as a company, you're not going to see a spike from year, you know, from this year to the next year, where there's just this huge increase in income. It's like our expenses generally almost match our income, which isn't a great way to run a business, but it's we are constantly growing. So there have been no outside investors. We've even looked for investors at a certain point. But again, on par with the rest of my career, when I knock on other people's door for help, I generally don't get any. And
and on par with what you've done, you don't necessarily want to give up control.
Correct. I mean, you know, I do in hindsight look back and thank God above that, like, I never signed a publishing deal and I never signed a record deal. I did sign a big record deal. And during that record deal, I had gotten a big advance, paid off a lot of the debt I had put myself into to get that record deal.
Right.
And halfway through the process of making my album, the label decided that they were going to fold. 9/11 happened. It really shook the economy. And part of that repercussion was this label saying, hey, I was the only artist on the label. And they're like, hey, we're going to fold. And by the way, we need all that money we gave you back. So that put me instantly right back in debt. And basically all my income was garnished for years. They took 50% of everything I made right off the top when I did anything in licensing. So
wow.
I went from feeling like I finally had made it, I'm on my way, to going right back into back to poverty. So even when I thought I got a break, I didn't. So, you know, after a while, this happens to a person. You eventually start to go, I don't even want to look. I don't even care. I'll just do this myself because I can control this at least. And that's really that's how Fixxd has.
Well, I love it. And I love that you never gave your publishing away, because do you know how many times I have to educate? I'll never forget artists. I'll never forget taking Taylor Swift backstage about 8-9 years ago when I was producing an award show with Debbie Gibson, of all people.
Mm-hmm.
I said, now, Debbie, please go talk to Taylor in the corner and tell her why it's so important as she's coming up that she never signs away her publishing, which is her mailbox money and her retirement for the rest of her life. And that was a great handoff to watch that happen, because Debbie never did either, you know. But so many artists don't know that that's what's going to happen, and they just sign their lives away.
Well, you know, when you're shooting for, you know, the stars and you're going to be a pop artist, that is definitely, yeah, that's, I mean, it's almost like you have to or you're never going to make it. I mean, they kind of put those kinds of people in those positions up against that wall. The fortunate thing for me, I'm underground. I'm not mainstream. I will never be played on the radio. You'll never see my face on MTV, and I'm not even sure if they have musicians on MTV anymore anyway. I don't really care. But, you know, what I do, you know, because of the way the internet has shaped the world that we live in, you can create a microcosm. You can create a little world that almost nobody else is aware of, but yet it sustains everybody within it, and you're keeping the entire fan base happy, and they are, they are the reason you're doing what you're doing. And it's like,
Todd shared that vision with you 20 years ago with Patronet, where an artist could live off a much smaller audience but keep 90 or 100% of the proceeds.
Exactly. And people are now just starting to figure that out. And, you know, I had to figure that out the long and hard way. There has been no – the advent of the MP3 and all that, I mean, there was no roadmap. I mean, music has completely changed. I was in the middle of that whole thing. And, you know, I was giving away my music on MP3.com back in the day because it brought me – enough income. It brought me a couple of $100 a month, which enabled me to like help pay my rent, you know. So I was going, great, if I can give the MP3s away and people are going to go stream these, and I can make even a few $100, that's keeping me alive.
Yeah,
so,
and I've spent a career helping to knock down those walls to liberate artists like you to go direct and make all this happen. But, you know, in the MP3.com days, I and even with BitTorrent, I advise artists who are still rising
to do those kind of deals directly. Better to get in front of 100 million people and take your chances than not get any payment at all or get 70% of it taken away from you off the top.
Yeah.
So different if you're a big artist, of course, but if you're rising, it helps. I would like to talk, Clayton, for just a bit about your time with Criss Angel, if you wouldn't mind, for the people that don't know about that part of your history in Vegas back in the mid-90s.
I wasn't even in Vegas. Criss and I knew each other in New York. I actually worked at a machine shop for his uncle. And what happened is his cousin, who was into really heavy music, after I'd quit that job and I went on to make my first few albums, which were really heavy kind of industrial albums.
Yes.
And I still kept in contact with his cousin. And his cousin, I guess at some point, had told Criss was playing like 80s metal kind of music, and he wanted to kind of he needed to revamp his sound. And he was looking for something harder and edgier. And I'm on tour, and right around the time that the label I was signed to basically was going bankrupt. And they said to me, you can't make a new record because we're going bankrupt, but we have you under contract, so you can't go anywhere else to make an album. So I was actually looking into the face of another situation where I was destined to fail because I didn't know how could I survive. I couldn't make another album, but I can't go anywhere else to get a deal, so I was screwed. And Criss came to me at that time kind of saying, hey, I'd love to talk to you about, producing some music for my thing. I've got this magic thing going. I remember him showing up, first time I ever met him, with these blueprints for this crazy stage show and all this kind of like all these crazy like illusion stuff he had built. And I didn't understand it because I was never really a fan of magic. I didn't really care about magic at all. But I saw the theatricality with what he was doing, and it wasn't like David Copperfield at all. It was completely different. So, it was somewhat fortuitous that, like, I was actually in a bad situation with my deal because I probably wouldn't have done that. I would have just been focused on my own thing, which was Circle of Dust, which was my project. So that ended up happening. What happened, as we worked together, we ended up becoming really good friends, and I finally was like, okay, I'm going to stop doing Circle of Dust. He asked me, hey, come be my partner in this magic music thing. Let's just write all the stuff together and perform and whatever. So we became business partners on that level, and I put Circle of Dust aside, and we were Angel Dust. It was Criss Angel and Circle of Dust, which was my project.
Right.
We became Angel Dust. So we've been friends now for, I don't know, 15, 20 years. I think we both lost count at this point. But, at some point it made sense for him. He was going much more in the magic direction, and me, like I said, I'm not really interested in magic per se. I'm just what Criss does is something different, but I wanted to make music and I wanted to focus on music, so it made sense for him to go do that and for me to that's when I formed Cell Dweller. That's when I decided this is going to be my new thing. It's going to be called Cell Dweller.
Yeah.
And so we stayed in contact, and now my music is 95% of his show at the Luxor, and there's only 5% that's not my music because contractually that's the way it needs to be. But his new show, The Supernaturalists, is all my music. So if you go see his new show, The Supernaturalists, which is touring, all the music in the show is mine.
That's fantastic. And, of course, your music's been featured in countless TV shows, films, and video games. But, that's got to be a huge joy and a challenge of fitting music to the screen. I know that, I should ask, is season 3 of Killer Instinct your first time scoring a production?
No, Kelly, I worked on Dead Rising 2. I wrote the theme song for Dead Rising 2, and I had some of my tracks licensed in the game, and then I scored 3 tracks for Dead Rising 3 as well. But Killer Instinct, the season 3 of the Killer Instinct game, is the first full-blown, like, full-scoring game that I've ever done. And I'm doing it with a seasoned veteran, Atlas Plug, who is Tom Salta, who's part of the Call of Duty franchise, Halo. He's done, just look him up and you'll see how much he's done. So
pretty
we
much
are
the top
actually
of the game.
We're in the thick of Killer Instinct right now.
I mean, listen, some people would just be thrilled to just be focusing on doing music for TV, film, and video games. I mean, in and of itself, that's a career. But you do that in tandem with the Cell Dweller live shows and your touring and such as well, and your own projects. What are some of the highlights that you really get enjoyment out of in terms of working in that genre?
Well, I really, again, not to beat a dead horse, but I am thankful to God above that I was in the right place at the right time. Nothing was ever given to me or handed to me. It's just the way things fell in the timeline of where music was and how music developed that I never gave away my publishing. I continued to focus on my artist's material, which is Cell Dweller. And so as that all kind of happened together, I've built a reputation and a fan base for myself that sustains Cell Dweller and thusly me, and where I could basically do anything I want as Cell Dweller. I can score a film, which I am also in the middle of doing right now. I'm actually working on two films, but I'm scoring one completely, and the other one I'm just doing synth programming for. So the movie I'm scoring is The Dunes. I'm scoring Killer Instinct. I just wrapped up my new artist album, End of an Empire, like we talked about. I'm bringing back my original project, Circle of Dust. I just bought back my first five albums. I now, for the first time in 25 years, own those. So I'm re-releasing them next year.
I love that.
But I'm able to, basically what I'm getting at is I can do anything I want to. So and of course that's a blessing and a curse because I'm not prone to just sit on the couch and watch TV. I always want to be doing something, so I end up taking on more than I can handle. But I feel very privileged that I can do that because there are people who, even if you are making music, you may be making music for films, but that's all you can do. I am an artist first, so I have been able to, as an artist, go score a game as this artist, Cell Dweller. I can go score a movie as Cell Dweller. I can tour. I can release albums, artist albums. I can pretty much do anything I want on my own timeline.
I think it's the most liberating possible position for all the pain you've had to endure. It's the ultimate freedom. The ultimate destination is the freedom to be creative in whatever way you define, and you've got it. You've hit the jackpot the hard way, but you're there.
Yeah, but you don't see it. Like, when I was coming up through it, all I saw ahead of me was failure.
Listen,
I mean, you know, you see the light at the end of the tunnel.
I was privileged to have Steve Jobs as a personal mentor. One of the famous quotes he issued, which he said all the time, was, "You can only connect the dots looking backwards."
Hmm.
And that's, now it all makes sense.
It
might not be pleasant, but you hit it. You've gone through the finish line, and you're just still at the early part of your career, as far as I'm concerned. And that brings me to pretty much one of my final questions for our time together, which is, what comes next? I mean, what's the one project or collaboration that you haven't yet started, but you dream about creating, given you have the freedom to do whatever you want?
Well, dreaming about doing things that I can already do those are cool because those give me goals, but dreaming for me has always been about doing things that I can't do. So at some point in my future, I would love to create a movie, like write a movie, potentially direct it, but mainly score it and basically have the entire product be something that came out of my head. Because like I said, I'm always thinking in musical and visual terms, and I feel like I would have a different take on that whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's a big undertaking, and I'm actually working on a few scripts with my friend Grant Mormon, who directed The Dunes, the movie I'm scoring as well. So we're working on ideas. I'm working towards that goal, and it could be another 10 years before that ever even happens. But that's something on my bucket list, and we'll see if that happens or if it doesn't.
Listen, it starts with setting a vision and an intention and then allowing the pieces to fall into place as they already have when you didn't know exactly how it was going to work.
Right.
So it works both directions. And the last question I was curious about to ask you is, how do you decide when to use these different monikers, Cell Dweller versus Clayton, for different projects?
Well, Clayton is my name, and Cell Dweller is my musical project. So really, you'll see the phrase in a lot of my social media, in my albums, it just says, Clayton is Cell Dweller. I'm trying to remove that that line where people are like, hey, I love your band, and it's like, there is no band. It's just
As opposed to like the Clatoo thing, which is... You know, who are these guys?
Right. Yes.
That was different because it was visual versus more Depeche Mode than the name of the band. But, you know, this whole thing about identity is very interesting because not a lot of people have to deal with that, and you've chosen to deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, branding. I mean, if you look at my early albums, my Circle of Dust albums, I was barely visible. I didn't really want pictures of myself. it was only after a while that I became a little more confident. I started putting pictures in the artwork, but I didn't really love to do it. And they were always generally theatrical. It wasn't just me standing in a T-shirt, you know, with you know, giving people a high five. But you know, that now we're in an age where people want accessibility to the artists that they follow and listen to. There's no reason they can't send you a tweet or a post on Facebook and you can't hit them back. And I am very active on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, just social media in general. So, you know, the visual aspect of it, you know, I don't tour a lot. I like being in the studio much more than touring, but being active on social media and posting photos and video of myself in real time right now allows people to feel like they're involved in my world. Even though I'm not standing on a stage in front of them, they're peeking into my world in real time. They can still see I'm alive and actually doing something.
Yeah.
So that's all part of branding and just, you know, people just seeing your face, I guess.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, listen, Clayton, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the show tonight. It's really been a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Kelly, for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to do this.
Yeah, it's been terrific. And as usual, I also want to thank my show producer, Jessica Mastros, for doing the great job she does every week, and the listeners for joining us. We'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.
Good night.